effective immediately. I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA. As for Mr. Sterling's ownership interest in the Clippers, I will urge the Board of Governors to exercise its authority to force a sale of the team and will do everything in my power to ensure that that happens.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver on the fate of Clippers owner Donald Sterling. So to recap, Sterling will have to pay $2.5 million and will be suspended indefinitely from running the team, attending any NBA games, or showing his face at any Clippers facilities. And the commissioner will pressure other NBA owners to force Sterling to sell the Clippers. Three-fourths of all team owners would have to vote for a sale in order to enforce it. This all stems from an audio tape of Sterling making racist comments that was leaked over the weekend to the media. Commissioner Silver confirmed today that it was, in fact, Donald Sterling's voice on that audio tape. Benga Ajilori is an associate professor of economics at the University of Toledo, also a lifelong Clippers fan, and he's been looking into the economic consequences of this whole story. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think of this punishment?
This is actually the strongest punishment that they could have given, and it was a little bit of a surprise because you don't usually see this a lot of times in the sports leagues that really coming down hard on owners. But with the new commissioner, he came in a couple months ago, he really wanted to put his foot down, and so this was the strongest that he basically could have done. And he did that and did it quickly, too.
Right, right. Well, I mean, quickly, though, the NBA has known about his views for many, many years and has done nothing. So what did he say today about that?
He actually avoided that question. Two people had brought it up, and he was saying that basically with the information, once they had evidence about it, they acted on it in this case. He mentioned the housing discrimination, that the case was settled, and then the employment discrimination with Elgin Baylor, that Elgin Baylor lost that case, so they couldn't do anything about that. But he basically sidestepped.
Former general manager of the Clippers.
Yeah, he basically sidestepped the question. I think a lot of it is that he didn't want to throw David Stern under the bus, their previous commissioner.
Right, right. Okay, so let's talk about this idea of a forced sale, and three-quarters of the owners have to agree to that. Tell me about that system. How would it work?
Basically, probably sometime in the next couple of weeks that they would have the owners get together. He said they'd have sort of an executive committee to basically talk about, okay, let's put this up to a vote. And 24 of the owners, if they say that he should sell, Donald Stern is going to have to sell. Now, the question is how they actually would go about the sale. We're not sure about how that works.
Right. And let's hear from Adam Silver about that.
I didn't poll the owners. I spoke to several owners, and I have their full support.
Okay, so I guess he'll have to go around and ask them, right, if they indeed want to force the sale one by one?
Well, I think actually they actually meet together as a group and will have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
So far, looking at Twitter and looking at some of the statements that some of the owners have made, there's a lot of people in support of actually having Sterling sell.
There is support for that.
Yeah, so far, Paul Allen, I know Mark Cuban, and a couple of the other owners have actually just recently said that they support the commissioner's decision and will put it up to a vote.
But what does that say about the owners' rights? I mean, are owners feeling a little weird about that, thinking, well, I could be next if someone doesn't like what I say?
Mark Cuban brought that up the other day, and a lot of it is a slippery slope because this was actually not, you know, a court case or some sort of outside. This was actually private tapes that were recorded that, you know, I know in the state of California that it would be illegal for it to record. And if that can force someone out, then that brings up a lot of concerns because you think about, you know, the whole debate about the NSA and wiretapping and all those spy things. That's the kind of stuff that people have been complaining about and talking about for the last year and a half. And so now we have a situation, even though it's with Donald Sterling, it's a similar kind of situation that was something Mark Cuban brought up.
Right. So, and I guess he would fight it. We don't know yet. He hasn't said anything about this.
We haven't heard anything from Donald Sterling yet.
Okay. What about the players? There was a question at the news conference today about whether or not they could leave if they didn't want to play for the Clippers anymore. And here's what Silver said.
If a player in the future doesn't want to play for the Los Angeles Clippers and he's under contract, we'll deal with that when it happens. But that's not my sense of where we are right now.
So what would it take to just break the contract, leave the team, and say, I don't want to work here anymore?
That would actually probably have to go through the players' union because everything is collectively bargained, and that would bring up a lot of difficult issues when it comes to breaking the contract. And I think a lot of what would happen before that stage, there's going to be a lot of work behind the scenes, but that's probably a question that won't come up until we figure out what Sterling's next move is going to be. Because even if he does, let's say the owners decide to force him out and force him to sell, if he litigates that, he is actually going to have a difficult time in terms of actually fighting that. Lester Munson from ESPN had talked about in the legal case, because it's a league and part of the league bylaws, you can't sue about bylaws that the owners agreed to. So it's one of those things where it may not, this may not be a case that comes up because Sterling is not going to be able to, if he's forced to sell, he's not going to be able to win that battle.
Can the union do anything? Can the players say, you know, I don't want to work in this hostile work environment or something like that?
The union can't do anything. The union can only make suggestions. And there was a recent conference that Kevin Johnson, Mayor Kevin Johnson and Mayor Eric Garcetti had, where we're talking about how the union was made a part of this decision, that they had talked to the commissioner. And that, but at most, the only thing it can do is make suggestions and ask to be a part of the process.
How much do you think the Clippers are worth?
So the Dodgers went for $2 billion about 2 years ago. And the Clippers, with their, I mean, they're in the playoffs right now. They have marketable stars in Chris Paul and Blake Griffin. They're a winning team. They're in a great market. Some people have suggested that if they were to sell, they would get at least $1 billion. Now, one of the other issues is that they're not the preeminent team in that market because you still compete with the Lakers. And then within the Staples Centers, you compete with the LA Kings, the hockey team. But they probably could easily get $1 billion. The Milwaukee Bucks, a downtrodden franchise, just sold for $550 billion. And so you have a team like that worth $550 billion. Clippers are at least $1 billion, probably more.
Is the Clippers, are they worth more now than they were on Friday or less?
That's a good question. I would say because this would be a forced sale, they're probably worth less. Now, let's say Donald Sterling, a month ago, Donald Sterling says, you know what, I'm old, I want to sell the team. He could have probably pushed for $1.5 billion. But because this is a forced sale, probably looking around at $1 billion. So they would probably be worth less because of this incident.
Still, $1 billion, not chump change. And does that all go to Mr. Sterling?
That would go to Mr. Sterling.
So... Yeah.
But that's one of the problems with leagues and issues with leagues and, you know, sports in general, is that there's only so much that you can do. A lot of people are complaining about that he's only being fined $2.5 million. He's being fined $2.5 million because that's the max. If $5 million was the max, he would have been fined $5 million. But the key here, and one of the things I wrote in my piece in the Washington Post blog, was that he's not going to voluntarily sell because he loves being an owner. And in sports is such a different industry than normal firms that people buy teams because they like what I call psychic benefits of owning a team, being courtside, being in the locker rooms, being part of this process.
But he doesn't get any of that now because he's banned.
No, and that's the important thing about Adam Silver's, the commissioner's ban, is that that's the one thing that could push for a voluntary sale. Because everything, you know, his whole identity for the last 30 years has been being the Clippers owner, being able to wine and dine people, have luxury boxes, being in a Staples Center. You know, before they were in a sports arena, which wasn't that great of an arena. Now they're in a Staples Center. That whole area is built up, and he's been a part of that, and now that's taken away from him, and that might get him to sell the team voluntarily. That might avoid a protracted legal fight.
So you've been a lifelong Clipper fan. What is this doing to you as a fan?
It's been tough.
Yeah.
And the tough part is that when you're a fan of the Clippers, knowing who Donald Sterling is, it's almost, you understand, you know, this has been tough. You know, he's not a good fan. He's not a good owner. But you know what? I like the team. I support the team. And it's just something that you know. And then what's been weird is that you have all this uproar, all this argument about, you know, this guy's terrible. Why is he not doing, you know, why is he racist? And then people wanting to protest. And the question comes up is, well, he's been like this forever. Where has this outrage been? The court case that was settled, the housing discrimination, was settled in 2009, but the case came up in 2003. You know, we heard about all these things, and there was no uproar. Now, part of the reason why there was no uproar is because the Clippers sucked and no one cared. But recently they become popular. You see Blake Griffin on Subway and Kia ads, Chris Paul on State Farm ads. You know, now you have, you know, I don't want to say bandwagon fans, but, you know, people are fans now of the team. And now they come up and then there's outrage. And part of it is that there should have been outrage before.
Yeah. Benga Adjelore, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Toledo. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so what do you think? Is the punishment harsh enough against Donald Sterling? Too easy? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Well, one of the questions at today's press conference to NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, would you consider more minority ownership of NBA teams? He said yes, of course. But the reality is only one team has an African-American owner, and that's Shaquille O'Neal, part owner of the Sacramento Kings. So it brings up the question as to just how diverse is the NBA and whether Sterling represents something more entrenched when it comes to race in professional sports. ESPN columnist Scoop Jackson is here now. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just want to correct real quick. I think Shaquille O'Neal is a minority owner with the Sacramento Kings. David Robinson has just become a minority owner with the San Antonio Spurs. The one majority owner that is black in the league is Michael Jordan of the Charlotte Hornets.
Right. Okay. Good. Thanks for that correction. But still, there are, you know, just a few there, and
it is very, very small.
And yeah, the NBA, the players, what? It's 80% black players.
Yeah, it's around 80%. That seems to be the number that seems to be floating around.
Right. So why? So
I don't know.
Owners?
I mean, we can ask the same question. I'm not deflecting on the question, but I think we can ask the same question about, you know, football, where they don't have any owners of color. Magic Johnson just became the first, you know, owner of a black owner in Major League Baseball. There are no black owners of any NHL teams. We can go down the line. You know, and look at the lack of ownership as far as black individuals in American sports. So it's, you know, it's not just basketball. And it necessarily doesn't have to do with the number of individuals that happen to be playing and participating in that sport. All professional sports organizations should be open to ownership of color. That being said, you know, I can't say that I've gone through and done enough investigating to see why. And that's going to be a hard, even if somebody did do it, it'd be hard to find a conclusive answer as to why, because you're going to wind up getting answers on all that, that run the gamut as to, you know, it's because of the economic situation, it's hard for, you know, African Americans to come up with the type of money that it takes to buy a franchise. You know, it's just like if you look at the list of billionaires. You know, you never see that many African-American black individuals that are billionaires. So, one, we're dealing with a money issue. And inside of that, you might find some issues of discrimination. There are people of color who have tried to come to the table with enough money, with groups that have enough money, that behind closed doors have been discriminated against. So you may find that also. So it's a tough question to answer.
Okay, I want to get back to the Clippers and the NBA for a little bit and talk about this issue with Elgin Baylor 5 years ago, saying Sterling had a vision of a Southern plantation-type structure for the Clippers, and he accused the owner of pervasive and ongoing racist attitudes. So the NBA knew full well what Donald Sterling was about back then and didn't do anything about that, and what's your take on that?
Well, I look at it like this. I look at it as, okay, this is an individual case. This is a lawsuit being brought up by a former employee, and we're going to let the courts handle this situation before, you know, we go in and do it. We're going to let their family handle this before we jump in to make some type of judgment or impose sanctions on what we feel is the evidence presented before us. And in Elgin Baylor's case, after working with the Clippers for 22 years, after being removed from his position, did he file a lawsuit? And when it went to court, he wound up losing. So I think the NBA was like, okay, it basically did its due diligence. We let the Clippers and we let Elgin handle this independently. It went to court. Here is what the courts found. Now, you got to understand, at the time, David Stern, who is a former lawyer, you know, looked at that, and most lawyers, to a certain degree, do respect the law. And they kind of do respect the decisions that are made when things are taken to court. Right. And I think that's why the NBA kind of washed their hands of it, because they're like, okay, it did go to court. If they found Donald Sterling guilty of what Elgin Baylor was accusing him with, then as an owner, we could go in and step in. But from a court decision, right, there's nothing for us to go in about.
Well, there was no court decision in this current case, and yet they went in quite forcefully.
Which one? In this one?
Yeah, in the current case. Yeah, the recording.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I was talking to my wife about this. This is one of those situations where, one, you have direct evidence, not hearsay. You have direct evidence in the form of audio tape.
Right.
And secondly, there's always a situation in situations like this, and this is what I was talking to my wife about, where you cross the line.
Yeah.
And I think in the NBA's case, not only did this go public, so now it becomes a PR situation, and not only did he do this as a representative of the Los Angeles Clippers, the slumlord situations, that he went to court with, were not necessarily connected to the NBA and his ownership of the Clippers. This conversation on audio tape had the direct link to the NBA because he's the owner of a Clippers, and the person at the center of this was the NBA player, being in Magic Johnson.
Yeah.
So those two things right there brought the NBA to this attention. Now, the third thing about it, and this is what my wife and I talked about, is that you put all that together, and the stuff that he said this time crossed the line. You know, it's like a kid behaving badly. That's what we equated it to.
Right.
If you have kids, your kid did this, your kid did that, but then when your kid crosses the line, that's when you're like, okay, now we have to punish you. You know you did wrong, but all right, that's not wrong enough. But it's always a situation where a line gets crossed. And this audio tape and what he said that expressed his feelings, that's, I think, what drew the line, where the NBA said, okay, we can't take anymore. We can't, not that we had a blind eye on this, but this is too much. He crossed the line on this, and we can't not do anything. Excuse my double negative, I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us today anyway.
Oh, no problem. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Scoop Jackson, ESPN columnist. All right, coming up on the program, what's Toyota's move from California to Texas? What does it say about how our car culture is changing? And we'll also talk about how to get beyond range anxiety with electric cars, our regular car segment, next on Press Play.
Like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The city of Torrance is still reeling from the news that Toyota is moving its North American sales headquarters out of town and taking 3,000 jobs with it. Devastating news for Torrance, and it says something about the auto industry as a whole, according to Matt DeBord. He's here now to talk about the latest in car news. He's our regular go-to car guy. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Toyota is not the only Japanese car company, to pack up and leave for other states.
This case,
Texas. So what's happening?
It's just another body blow to California as far as the state of the auto industry here is concerned. We had Toyota and Honda still down in the South Bay. Nissan packed up and left, went to Tennessee a while back. And it just says a lot about the changing nature of car culture in America. I mean, we still have the dominant car culture in the land here in California. I mean, this is car land. But it's just not as viable a place as it used to be for these major foreign car makers to set up their U.S. operations. Part of it has to do with the fact that the entire auto industry, the manufacturing component of it, has moved into the southern U.S.
And that's because these are right-to-work states?
They're right-to-work states. That's part of it. And the states have been very friendly as far as setting up a favorable business environment for companies like Toyota, Honda, Nissan, BMW. I mean, it's all over the place. It's Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, Tennessee. It's Detroit South, basically, is what it's being called at this point. So for Toyota, it does make a lot of sense to move a bunch of people to Texas. They can be closer to their southern manufacturing operations. And it's not a big deal for the Japanese executives who run Toyota to get to Texas anymore. It used to be kind of a problem. You had to be in L.A. because you had LAX and it was the closest point of entry. And they've been down in Torrance since the early 80s. And actually, they've had significant operations in California for a long time before that. But it's just, it makes me sad, Madeline.
It does. Why? Why so sad?
It used to be that if you wanted to do cars, you had to have a presence in California. But increasingly, you don't. It's just the world we live in, you know. So it may,
what does get done here? What will those remaining 2,000 or so Toyota employees do here?
It's going to be primarily design and engineering, things of that nature. Car designers, you know, don't have to be in California anymore, but a lot of them like to be in California because you drive around California, you see a lot of what's going on. California is still kind of the crucible of innovation and invention in the auto industry. Right.
Tesla's based here.
Precisely.
For example.
You know, the marquee brand that we have left in California at this point is Tesla up in Fremont, you know, which is Northern California, obviously. But they're the car maker of the future in a lot of people's imagination. So that's something. But they're tiny. They're tiny. They're not Toyota. They're nowhere near as large as Toyota, right? So it slightly breaks my heart, to be quite honest with you. I wasn't surprised by the announcement, but I'm saddened.
Okay, the used car market. A lot of us like to look at the used car market because you can get a really good deal.
Sure, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
But for a while, there wasn't much of a used car market.
Yeah, the used car market got obliterated during the financial crisis, in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And that's because, you know, there were just not a whole lot of cars being sold. So in order for there to be used cars, there need to be new cars. Every used car started its life
as a new car. Fancy that.
Right. So what happened
Deep
was...
Deep thoughts with Matt DeBoer.
I know. We do explore topics of a philosophical nature here, despite all the heavy metal I'm talking about. But what really went down was that these car makers didn't build any cars for a long time. So there were no new cars. Therefore, there were no used cars. And what happened was nobody could afford a new car. People had job losses and credit was damaged and everything
so
like
that.
So
they're hanging on to their cars.
But they're hanging on their cars for a very long time. You know, the average age of a vehicle in the U.S. right now is 11 years old, which is just ridiculous. But there's a lot of cars being, people are the economy's better. The so-called replacement market is back and people are starting to replace their vehicles. But the thing is that for a long time, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, it was really expensive to buy a used car. People were furiously competing, and they didn't have enough supply to satisfy this all this demand. So law of supply and demand, naturally, the prices went up. Things are a little bit more back to normal now, so you can go and get a pretty good deal. It's the advice that you always heard. You know, I'm sure you heard this advice, like don't buy a new car, buy a gently used,
yes.
A couple years old, right? That market was almost, you know, it was challenging for a couple of years there, but it's back to normal now. And so you can actually go out and find some really, I'll speak to the consumer now. If you're looking for a car, you can go out and get a really great deal on a used car at this point. And in particular, you want to look at, you know, like luxury brands. A lightly used luxury car is actually a pretty good deal right now. And if you're interested in getting into a mark like Acura or Lexus, something like that, this is a great time to be evaluating that used car option.
Matt, you've been trying out some electric cars recently, and you've come up with this term. Well, it's not yours, but you're embracing it. Range anxiety.
Range anxiety. Yes. I had a Fit.
I see you have it.
I had a Fit EV, which is a little electric car that they're selling right now. Terrific car. A lot of fun to drive. But it was terrifying. And I'd always scoffed at range anxiety. I said, oh, come on. You know, you just find a place to charge the car up or you keep it charged up in advance. It's no big deal. But there I was driving home in my Fit EV, watching it go from 10 miles of range left to 9 miles of range left to 8 miles of range left to 7 miles of range left.
What's the total range for it?
You get about 80 to 100 miles on a charge, depending. It's fine. It's just if you do a little bit of driving around, and then as I do, I drive from Pasadena down to USC and then USC back, I pretty much gobbled up all the charge. And I thought, wow, geez, this is what range anxiety actually, I'd never experienced it in
the
flesh.
But if you plug it in every night, though.
It is okay if you plug it in every night, but you have to wait, you know, 10 hours for it to get completely charged up. So, you know, you wake up in the morning, if it's not all the juice isn't there, you don't even get your 80 miles, let's say. You might only be at 60 miles, you know. Most people can manage 50, 60 miles. It's okay. But if you do have to run some errands and things like that, you can run up against range anxiety.
So basically, this is a car for just short little errands.
I think so.
To
I
the
think
store, it's, to pick up your kids from school, and nothing big.
Pretty much, if you have a short commute, if you're just picking up your kids, if you're just bopping around town, it's fine. If you have to do any more serious driving than that, you will experience range anxiety, Madeline.
Well, so who's coming up with a solution to this?
Well, you know, Tesla has because, you know, they have a car that gets tremendously good range, you know, pushing 300 miles on a charge. The charge times are still the same. It takes forever to charge the vehicle up unless you use high-speed charging, and even in that case, it still takes a while. And most of the automakers are looking into innovative battery technology to be able to extend range. And then, of course, you always have hybrid options. So you've got some battery power, and you've got the good old-fashioned gas tank, so you can run the vehicle on gas if you encounter the terrifying scenario of range anxiety in your own life.
I see. This sounds like a movie. Okay. Matt DeBord is a freelance auto journalist, and he teaches business writing at USC. Thanks, Matt.
A pleasure.
Coming up, the history of the modern workplace. It's the subject of a fascinating new book. The author of Cubed, that's about cubicles, yes, Cubed, is here after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's talk about a place most of us know all too well, and that is the office. More than half of us spend most of our waking hours in cubicles, and really, we'd rather not.
Hello, Peter. What's happening? I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too, okay?
The 1999 movie Office Space is a cult hit, and it became so by tapping into our collective hatred for petty, meaningless, dominating office culture. So if we hate working in teeny boxes under fluorescent lights surrounded by file cabinets so much, how did we get here? Nikhil Saval is author of a new book called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, where he tries to answer that question. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the cubicle. It really has become this iconic hallmark of the modern workplace. And talk about the guy, his name is Robert Probst, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's right, yeah.
Who pretty much invented the cubicle. And he didn't set out to create this farm of anonymous, soulless places to work, really. He had a different idea altogether.
No, in fact, he had pretty much the opposite idea. Robert Probst was hired by the Herman Miller Company, a furniture company based in Michigan, to revolutionize the office. You know, what the office that he found at the time was sort of an open plan setup. I mean, people know the images, I think, from films like The Apartment or even Mad Men, where you have a steno pool with just row after row of very carefully arranged desks and corridor offices around the side. And he realized that people in the center actually needed privacy. They needed space. They needed something to call their own. They needed autonomy and independence. And he wanted it to be very flexible, and he wanted it to be very, I don't know, just something that you could make your own. And so he had a couple attempts at it, and sort of the most successful version was this thing called Action Office 2, which, I mean, just the very phrase suggests the sort of thing that you're supposed to be doing at it. You're moving constantly. It had many different levels. You were supposed to be standing up a lot and just you could pace in it. It was meant to be also flexible. It was a three-walled shape, but it was actually usually 120 degrees. That was the normal angle. And it could be a box or it could be a sort of hexagonal arrangement. It could do anything. That was the idea anyway. And when he debuted it, it was tremendously successful. And a lot of companies started to copy it. And it was really in the copying and in the replicating that it started to become something like a box. Managers realized that it was really very useful for cramming as many people into a small space as possible. It saved costs, and it gave workers this semblance of privacy and autonomy without really delivering it.
Yeah. What did he think when he saw what happened to his invention?
Well, it took time, I think, for him to realize what was happening. It was a sort of Frankenstein situation where he suddenly, there was this monster on the loose just in, you know, in offices. And by the end of his, near the end of his life, I think, in the late 90s, you know, well after Dilbert and, you know, just before Office Space came out and it was the cubicle had acquired the connotations it had, he recognized that he did not realize that most workplaces were not enlightened and did not share his vision of worker independence and autonomy, and that he said that people crammed these people into barren rat holes, hell holes, basically. Yeah, so he was very upset at what had happened, and I think he was not happy to be termed the father of the cubicle.
Well, go back to the sort of the origins of the modern office space. And really, it was seen in the beginning, I suppose, as a refuge from the factory, from dangerous and inhumane conditions on the factory floor. And so did people originally embrace office culture?
Yes and no. It did have a high level of prestige associated with it because it was so clean, not dangerous. It didn't require a lot of physical effort except for the occasional box to be lifted and sort of like today. And for that reason, it did have a kind of status associated with it. On the other hand, these early sort of clerical offices in mid-century America were often seen as just bizarre places because they weren't, at that point, a majority of workplaces. So clerks were seen by commentators at the time, I mean, journalists, but also the poet Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe, they wrote these very satirical pieces on clerks as these unmanly, narrow-chested, pale people who didn't do real work. They just did paperwork, you know, and it was both just hilarious to them, but also somewhat upsetting as a form of work that anyone would choose in America, which was supposed to be a republic of farmers, of manual laborers, of people, of craftsmen, and not this very strange specimen of individual doing this very strange kind of work.
Yeah, so it wasn't seen as manly. It wasn't seen as a masculine endeavor.
No, and in fact, you actually have clerks at the time who recognize this and become real advocates for what are essentially the origins of the modern gym. They say, I mean, we don't want to look like this way. We want to look like real manly Americans, and so they. There are clerks who start to set up these exercise societies, and in a way, there's a sort of parallel with gym culture today, which is populated by a lot of office workers.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Nikhil Saval. He's author of a new book called Cubed: A Secret History of the Workplace. Originally, these forward thinkers, when they come to planning the office or the skyscraper or the office park, they do have utopian visions for the workspace. They do think that this new design will bring about a revolution to the office that will make everybody happy. Why is this persistent utopian vision when it comes to planners of different office spaces throughout the years?
Well, I think it in a way, it goes back to the sense of the office as being just a perfect emblem of American or, you know, capitalist meritocracy. The sense that you know, even in clerical offices, the early offices, that you could start very much at the bottom, but that you had a path upward that was outlined for you that could, you know, if you worked hard, if you were smart enough, that you would just rise to the top of your workplace. So there was a way in which the office could be seen as a potential utopia, just a potential utopia of constant striving and upward mobility. And I think designers and planners were always trying to make that easier, to make it harmonious, to make it seem like it just worked perfectly, and to militate against things like, you know, just to plan against things like office politics and just petty exploitation and domination that we also know from office work, so that we sort of have those, there's a contradiction at the heart of the office between the ideal of it and the lived reality of it for many people who don't make it or who don't enjoy this sort of backstabbing and striving that you may actually have to do in many workplaces.
Right. So despite all the different designs, human behavior remains the same no matter what the office space looks like?
The designs can't really change hierarchies. You know, there are all these attempts on the part of designers to make things seem as if they're not what they are. And so for one example is the invention of the open plan office, which is all the rage now, but it actually came out of Germany in the 1950s, and it was called the office landscape. And the idea was to bring people out of private offices so that, you know, it wasn't a sign of prestige or your status in the company that you had earned this private office. It was just what made the work easier and what made the workflow easier. And also the idea was to make it more egalitarian, to make everyone seem like they had the same place in the company. Of course, that still didn't change whether they did or didn't have the same mm-hmm. place in the company. And there were even attempts to, you know, there were attempts by managers in these workplaces to siphon off a few extra plants or sound screens and actually create little private offices so that they could regain their status. And, you know, at the same time, noise, distraction, all the things that we associate with open office plans today, they proliferated. So ultimately, the sense of there just being an arbitrariness to it and planners imposing a vision on workers no matter what their work was, that persisted.
Where is the office now? It seems that we're in an era of upheaval with a lot of temp workers now not tethered to an office and a lot of workplace protections gone, unions evaporating. So what's happening with the modern office?
Well, the modern office seems to be going in many different directions. I mean, it's true that one of the major changes in the last 20 or 30 years, and it may have accelerated recently, although it's hard to measure, is the increase in temporary work, in work by contractors, by freelancers. And that that should actually be, you would think that that would actually be leading to the dissolution, let's say, of offices, or certainly the shrinkage of offices. But something curious has happened, which is that to kind of house these workers, there's been this new concept called co-working facilities, where freelancers ultimately pay for a desk in an office. And so really what's happening is that the office is being, you know, that sort of phenomenon, the fact that people would actually, who don't have to work in an office, would still nonetheless seek an office, which I think should really be more astonishing than it is a sign that the office is being changed from a place where you fundamentally have to go to work, and that's where you go, and that's where your work is best done, to a place where sort of social and cultural aspects of an organization or a company are made. You know, that a company culture or organizational culture is made in an office, but that work might actually, which a lot of which requires privacy and concentration, might better be done elsewhere. I mean, this is not the rule in many offices. Of course, many places still require you to go to work, but I think it's becoming less and less justifiable. And I think, you know, the sort of kerfuffle that happened a little while back over Yahoo's decision to eliminate telecommuting. I mean, one of the reasons that was so controversial was that it seemed to go against the whole direction that the office was going, that if you needed to work from home or if you needed to work from home part of the time, of course you would.
But so ironically, you've got places in Silicon Valley and even here in Los Angeles where the office has become a 24/7 place for people to be and where leisure time and office work time are conflated.
Yeah, those are some of the sort of, in some ways, some of the most famous offices of our time. And they're odd. I mean, certainly a lot of people who work in them do like them, and they do like, especially I think, the pace of certain kinds of work, like for engineers or coding, where it is very punctuated, and you work for a little while, and then you get up and you exercise, and then you work a little bit more, and then you play a video game, and then you work a little bit more, and then you go bowling in your office. You know, I mean, this. In a way, it suits certain kinds of work. On the other hand, it does have a very odd effect, which is that it creates this sort of city within an office and strips all those services from outside the from the surrounding areas. And so you have these, you often find these cities where you find these dot-com companies, there's not a lot around them because the workers don't really need to go outside. And so I think it's odd that they seek so much to, I mean, people have commented on this, that they seek so much to resemble cities at the same time that they actually try to not engage with city life more generally and aren't really good neighbors.
Nikhil Saval is the author of a new book called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
SkyMall, is that a secret pleasure for you when you get on an airplane, reach into the seat back pocket and pull out that catalog with items such as the bug vacuum and the Siamese blanket? Well, SkyMall is in trouble financially. We're going to find out what happened next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. I don't have to tell you that long flights are really a drag. So you can read or you can maybe watch a stale rom-com. If you're lucky, maybe you can sleep. I don't know. But maybe the best thing to keep you happily occupied for many, many hours is going into the seat back pocket and pulling out a tattered, well-worn copy of SkyMall. Nothing makes the time pass quite like leafing through the catalog of, you know, those useful items like a necklace that holds your wine glass or a solar-powered cooling hat. I have some bad news, though. SkyMall is in the red, and its future looks bleak. Reporter Hugo Martin read about that in the LA Times. Hi.
Hi. So thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure, although this is a sad moment to talk about. Is SkyMall crashing, really?
There's hope. I mean, SkyMall realizes that the future is not in, you know, catalogs like, you know, Sears and Roebuck and those sort of things. They realize that if they're going to stay alive, they've got to start selling their goofy items through the internet. And so they're trying to make a shift and get more people to buy their stuff with their cell phones and smartphones and iPads and all that other stuff that people are lugging around on planes.
So people are just looking at that and not picking up the magazine? Is that the problem?
Well, yeah. It used to be that they had a captive audience that, as you said, you're on a plane and what else is there to do? But now you can bring your devices on planes, and something like 40-50% of planes in the U.S. now have Wi-Fi. And there's even, you know, the FCC is talking about letting us use our cell phones. So the future looks like it's going to the internet, I mean, for onboard entertainment.
Where did SkyMall come from, and why does it have a monopoly on airplanes?
It was invented by a guy named Robert Worsley about 24 years ago. And I don't know if you recall, back in the 80s and 90s, planes used to have these phones sort of stuck in the back of the planes, right? And you could make phone calls. And he was on a flight, and he thought, well, why don't we make a catalog where people could order through these phones, you know, order something, and it's going to be delivered at the airport where you land. That was his original idea. It turns out people didn't want to land in an airport and have to, you know, lug whatever, you know, product they bought, like a automatic cat litter box or something like that.
And so it's a little bulky, yeah.
That part of the idea sort of fell away. But the idea of having a catalog in the seat back where you can order stuff, you know, from this captive audience, that took off. Eventually, you know, he negotiated exclusive contracts with just about every major domestic flyer in the U.S. And that's how SkyMall started.
That's smart, though. Did he make a lot of money?
Yeah, he sold it. I think it was like $47 million back a few years ago, and now he's a politician.
So you went to meetings where they pick the products for the catalog.
Right.
And I guess I want to know, do they pick the most ridiculous products on purpose? Are they self-aware that people are actually looking at this as a source of entertainment?
Yeah. They actually, I mean, it's one of the things that Worsley realized when he invented this, is that if you sell stuff that people can get anywhere, you know, they're not going to buy it on a catalog. If you find them stuff that they're not going to find at their Target or Walmart, that's the sort of thing that sells the most. So their motto is to find the coolest stuff on earth. So they send out what they call product managers to all kinds of places. They go to inventors conventions and toy conferences and all kinds of places all over the country and try to find these things. Among the criteria for choosing these products is how unique is it? Does it solve a problem? Is it something that you could, you know, promote on social media? Various, you know, things like that. But yeah, it is.
It's safe to say that very few of the items are actually necessities.
Exactly. Oh yeah, almost none of it is, unless you need, like, you know, a raised pet bed. I mean, if that's something that's really important to you, then you'll find it on SkyMall.
Right. And so are they thinking, well, you're in this kind of strange state on the airplane where you're maybe more prone to make impulse purchases and buy weird items?
Right. You're groggy from lack of sleep.
You're bored.
You're at 35,000 feet. Maybe the oxygen is not, you know, getting to the brain.
And some of those things are like, hey, Em, that seems kind of reasonable. I could use a wine necklace.
Yeah, no, and I've talked to a couple of people who say they open it thinking, oh, I'm just going to look for fun and see all the goofy items. And then they end up buying because they're like, wow, I got to have that.
So when you visited them, did they have, you know, they sell all those motivational posters in the catalog, like, you know, a soaring eagle. Were those posters on the walls in the offices when you went to visit?
Yeah. They had all the items sort of scattered around. The Yeti, the Garden Yeti is the biggest seller, though, of course.
Oh, of course. Everyone has to have one.
I don't know why, but apparently that's their biggest seller.
Biggest seller. So what is going to happen? I can't imagine people actually in real life down on the ground downloading an app and ordering SkyMall stuff, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you know, they still have this exclusive agreement with all the airlines that the catalog will be, you know, in the seat backs of every domestic airline. But what they want to do is they want to make, first of all, their website a lot better. They're going to upgrade it so that there's video. You could see the product, you know, being used. And, yeah, they want an app so that you could just point your smartphone at the item on the catalog page and then push a button and, boom, you've bought it. It's going to be sent to your home. And they're hoping this kind of thing will, you know, boost sales and sort of get them out of this rut they're in.
And any plans to make over the catalog itself?
No, they didn't really talk about that. I mean, the one thing that the catalog is going to have less of is, you know, in the back there's pages where you could, you know, fill it out and put it in the mail, old snail mail. And I think they want to do less of that and more of the push one button on your smartphone kind of sales.
So they're not out of it yet. I mean, there's still going to be SkyMall for a while.
Yeah, no, they still think they have, you know, a pretty viable product. I mean, they do sell pretty well, but it's not what it used to be, and they're hoping they can turn it around.
All right. Well, I certainly hope so.
Because you still haven't got yourself a Garden Yeti.
I know. Right? I better act fast.
Well, you want to be with the in crowd.
Hugo Martin wrote about SkyMall for the LA Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jolie Meyer's back from, where were you?
I went to Joshua Tree, but I heard that there were people on hunger strike waiting for me to come back, and people were rending their garments, and so I decided to cut it a little bit short and come back. You guys go pick up the kids from the grandparents, go back to work, it's fine, I'm back, okay? And I'm not leaving again.
Let me tell you, that Bigfoot Garden Yeti sculpture is a bargain at $98.95.
Do you have that up? So I went.
I do.
I actually went through the SkyMall online catalog to find my favorite stuff, and it's Definitely the Juicy Couture Shampooch, which is pet shampoo. That was my favorite item.
You just like the ad copy.
I am such a big fan of puns. That one took me, and I am very taken with it. But there was also a wine sippy cup that I happened to really enjoy. So, SkyMall, you have my business.
Oh,
that's
my
for
gosh.
Sure.
There, I just, yeah, once you get on this, well, anyway.
Right.
Vortex.
Well, once you're looking for your $140 designer litter box enclosure, you mean? Well, moving on to the big story of the day, and that would be the Clippers. Donald mm-hmm. Sterling's been banned for life from the NBA. We got a lot of reaction, of course. Gregory gave us a call, and he thought that the sanctions were a bit harsh.
I do not condone Sterling's remarks at all, but there is a scapegoat mechanism happening here that is of concern. He does have the rights to be a racist, and we need to explore where his personal rights end and his public responsibility begin.
So he's pointing out that Donald Sterling has a First Amendment right to say the things that he wants to say, but, you know, as we've seen, the NBA is not necessarily a democracy.
Right.
So we'll see about how the owners vote when it comes to stripping him of his team, or making him sell it, that is. Mira tweeted at us, and she said that Sterling's punishment is long overdue, but she said in all of this talk about black team owners, why not a woman owner? Mira thought that Oprah would be a good owner for that. She certainly has the money, mm-hmm. so maybe she could pick up a little sports team.
Well, there's Jeannie Buss, right?
Yeah, Jeannie Buss, yeah. But it could be one of Oprah's favorite things. You get tickets to the Clippers. You get tickets to the Clippers. You get tickets to the Clippers. Courtney Thomas says, though, on Facebook that she doesn't care who buys the team, just as long as they stay in Los Angeles. So I'm not sure if the Clippers could be moved out of Los Angeles with a new owner, but we'll see how it shakes out.
Well, yeah, and we'll follow the story. It is a fast-evolving story. Lots of interesting twists and turns, as they say. And that's about it for your twists and turns, right?
That's it. That's all I got.
Get back to SkyMall. Jolie Myers. And coming up next, Warren Olney, To the Point. Actually, Barbara Bogave filling in for Warren Olney today and To the Point at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.